welcome back to Franklin Covey's twice weekly podcast on Leadership with Scott Miller. I'm your host each week, 6 years running, never missed an episode all through the pandemic because Franklin Covey's mission is to help people really aspire to achieve their own great purposes, to help organizations and people really discover how they can be the best, most effective versions of themselves. This podcast has over 350 episodes taped. We have interviewed business CEOs, titans, celebrities, actors, athletes, researchers, people that are household names, and other times people who may not be a household name but have dedicated their lives to discovering a solution, defining a problem. Perhaps they even suffered some unspeakable tragedy or trauma and lived to share about it to help us be better leaders both in our organizations, in our homes, with our families, and our friends, and our communities. And I'm privileged to be the host of Franklin Covey's On Leadership Spotlight, where we, twice a week, interview guests. Sometimes they are internal thought leaders. Oftentimes they are outside of the organization. Today we have a friend of the family. You may know Joel Peterson is a member of our board of directors. He is also a member of the faculty graduate school at Stanford. And one of his colleagues and friends, David Dotson, has joined us today. David is the author of the USA Today and Wall Street Journal best-selling book, The Manager's Handbook. Tagline, 5 simple steps to build a team, stay focused, make better decisions, and crush your competition. David Dotson, welcome to On Leadership.
Great, thanks. Let's get into it, Scott. I'm excited.
You know, after 350 episodes, we've interviewed a few experts on leadership and management. And there's this age-old debate around management and leadership. You know, you manage things and you lead people, you manage processes, you lead culture. I would argue that they actually can be used somewhat interchangeably. I know a lot of managers that need to be better leaders. I know a lot of leaders that can be better managers. David, was there any particular reason, as being on faculty at Stanford and, you know, been in the leadership entrepreneurial business for decades, any reason why you chose to call it the manager's handbook?
That's really interesting, Scott. And you and I have never talked about this before, but the probably the biggest sort of debate I had with the publisher and with my friends, including my wife, was whether we were going to use the word leader or leadership or manager in the book. And I ended up having a pretty strong opinion that I wanted to use the word manager, because while we talk a lot about leadership, we oftentimes forget that the underpinnings, the foundation of good leadership is being able to manage well, the skill of being able to get things done. And I do, by the way, reject the theory that some people have that they're separate. You know, being a good manager, for example, includes how to give good feedback and how to give feedback. And I discuss in the book, you know, the 6 steps to giving good feedback. But of course, that's part of good leadership as well, right? So I do think that they're you can't really pull them apart. But I wanted someone to look at the book and say, okay, I want to not only myself get better at getting things done, but I want to build an entire organization that's better at getting things done. So that's why I ended up with the title manager.
Beautifully said. I have to tell you, I couldn't agree more with you. I know a lot of leaders that are very aspirational, very strategic thinkers, big vision, creative, but they can't manage the quarterly revenue or profit to save their life. And they also can't necessarily manage accountability. And so I think all of us at times in our career need both management and leadership. David, rewind a couple of decades, reintroduce yourself to all of our guests. You've done a lot of things and have had some sage advice for us today. Before we start there, give us the crib sheet on your professional history.
Yeah, so I grew up in rural Colorado, and the whole world was sort of separated between farmers and ranchers. So I grew up in a very rural environment, pretty sheltered actually. And funny enough, I went to Stanford undergrad. The reason I wanted to go to Stanford undergrad is I saw someone walk by who had the Coors beer franchise in our area, and he had a Stanford sweatshirt on. So I thought, oh, okay, I think I should go to Stanford. And I kid you not, when I applied to Stanford, I did not even know what state Stanford University was located in. So that's how kind of sheltered I was. Didn't have a lot of money growing up. I took my classes in the morning so I could work in a meatpacking plant in the afternoon in San Jose because it paid well. So I had kind of that sort of a gritty growing up in background. But Stanford really opened up this world to me about that maybe I could be better, or maybe I could aspire to things that I didn't previously think I could aspire to. So I worked for McKinsey, realized that as much as I admired that organization, it was not how I wanted to spend my life. Came back to business school at Stanford, and all I could think about is how I wanted to run and build something over and over again. And at that point, Stanford's a very entrepreneurial school now, but back then it was more about going to be an investment banker or going to be a consultant or going to work at General Motors. But I could not get it out of my head that I wanted to run something and I wanted to build something. So one day I called up everybody who I was interviewing with and took my name out of the hat. Went and talked to a professor of mine, a guy named Irv Grossbeck, who had built a huge media company and came back to teach. And I said to him, "I don't care what I do. You don't have to pay me. I just want to work for you. I'll wash your car." And so I worked for him for a year. And that really set off my life trajectory, which has been as an entrepreneur. And I've been CEO or executive chairman of five companies, been on probably, 50 boards. And principally now, I coach and mentor, early CEOs and leaders, both as a on the faculty at Stanford, then also in my investment firm. And I just love, love, love the subject of management and leadership. And I remember Irv Grossbeck had said one thing to me. He said, "What we do is honorable because we impact people's lives." And as I think back on my own life as a CEO, the memories that I remember are those interpersonal interactions that I had with people, someone who I hired who was maybe working in the call center and they ended up becoming a vice president. Those are the things that make being a manager and being a good leader so incredibly rewarding and frankly important.
David, I want to dive into this book. Before I do so, I want to pay appropriate accolades to your book. As I mentioned to you off air, I have no credibility when it comes to recommending restaurants or movies, but I'm arguably one of the world's, I think, most credible recommenders of leadership books, having interviewed nearly every leadership author in the world, certainly those who speak English, having read literally thousands of books over the course of my 30 career in what I think is the world's most prestigious leadership development firm, the Franklin Covey Company, including having served as the CMO for nearly a decade. Your book is extraordinary, and I don't want it to get lost in what is a sea of leadership books. I want to repeat the title again for those who are listening. It's called The Manager's Handbook: Five Simple Steps to Build a Team, Stay Focused, Make Better Decisions, and Crush Your Competition. This book was a Wall Street Journal bestseller. We're going to dig into some items here. I highly recommend everyone who is listening today to buy this book because, for me, a guy who's been in this business 30 years, I found myself reading it with one of two things happening: finding you validating me on something I already knew, but reinforcing it, or giving me a perspective I thought, gosh, that's a really good idea. Kind of, how have I missed that? I want to dig into some of those. First, you talk about the five must-have skills from people who get things done, right? Commitment to building a team, fanatical custodian of time, willingness to seek and take advice, setting and adhering priorities, and an obsession with quality. I've picked a few out that I found particularly enlightening, and I want to do a deep dive with them. One is about meetings. Seven steps to running a great meeting. I have to tell you, I read your book 4 days ago and I did a TikTok video and I took a bunch of your ideas and put it in my TikTok video because I thought one of your ideas around being intentional with who you invite to a meeting is such a great decision. Walk us through your expertise on what makes a great meeting.
So we all know that basically meetings are kind of broken. And they're even more broken now that so many of them are taking place remotely. There was a statistic that was done after a fair amount of work, Bain & Company. The average manager spends 23 hours a week in meetings. We actually don't realize how much time we spend in meetings. And half of those attendees reported that the meetings were either ineffective or highly ineffective. So we're wasting a massive amount of time. It's not just wasting time, though, because the issue with meetings is we spend too much time in them, kind of all know that, but also we don't optimize the decision-making process of it. So what I did, I I didn't pretend to be the best person at running meetings. I went out and I looked at who were the very, very best people out there reputationally and how they ran meetings. They all ran them a little differently, but I found these common themes. And so when I wrote the book, rather than tell us our war stories about, well, this is what Sheryl Sandberg did at Meta, and this is what Jeff Bezos does at Amazon, and let the reader sort it out, I harmonized it into, as you know, Scott, a step-by-step approach to how you run meetings. And my hero in this is actually Jeff Bezos. You know, we think of Jeff Bezos as a guy who can see around corners and sort of a visionary and so forth, but he was first and foremost a manager. And he insisted that the meetings at Amazon be run a certain way, and then he insisted that all meetings in Amazon be run a certain way. And that was what was so transformative when I was working on this chapter, because I realized it's not that actually that helpful for just the CEO or just you to be running meetings well. It's transformative when your entire organization does. And that's why Amazon makes better decisions and they make faster decisions, and why they have crushed their competition.
Well, illuminate some of those ideas, because in your book, which literally is a handbook, you give five or six, or I guess it may be seven strategies, remind everybody what your aggregate research showed are the five or six or seven things people should do. Rattle them off real quick.
Yeah, so it's basically everything in this book is formulaic. So you start a meeting by saying, this is the problem we're trying to solve or the opportunity we're trying to take advantage of. Being able to articulate that is really important to be able to do. And most people just sort of want to talk about it at the issue. So you have to articulate exactly what we're doing here. The second thing is you ask for clarifying questions. You don't want to start the conversation until everybody's sure on what this number meant or what that graph meant. So you ask for just clarifying questions. Then you dive into the discussion itself. And I personally love the idea of asking people to talk in reverse order of seniority. So you really get the full benefit of everyone's in the crowd. People aren't sort of guessing what the boss is thinking or saying, oh, that must not be a good idea because that's not what the boss said. So you try to talk to people in reverse order of seniority. Then you summarize what you believe the group decided on. And then you finalize with a quick little email saying, it's not a summary of the meeting, who said what, but it's a summary of the decision that's were made. What do the dates do and who's doing what? It's that simple. I run every meeting like this, Scott, and our meetings take so much less time. And by the way, everybody loves the meetings because we go in there and we go, we got stuff done today.
David, drill deeper. One more thought on this. Talk about how important it is to curate your guest list.
Oh, yeah. So especially because of today's technology where it is so easy with cell phones, computers, and so forth to add attendees. And there's nothing, no worse waste of time to have somebody in there who doesn't need to be in the meeting. So this is something that Google does. And Eric Schmidt was very, one of the founders of Google, was very specific about is that if you're in a meeting, you must participate in the meeting. You're not there in an audience. And so if you ask yourself the question, okay, what is the minimum number of people we need in order to make the right decision? Not everyone we can attend. And then everybody must participate. Then you get your attendee list down lower. And by the way, you free up people to go and work on something else that they should be working on. The other thing that you can do is if you've got a 40-minute meeting, everybody doesn't need to be there for the first 40 minutes. So if someone is important for the first part of the meeting, have them on the first part of the meeting and then dismiss them so that they can go work on something else.
David, we all have brands and reputations. I know people that you want to invite them to the meeting, but their meeting style is kind of cancerous, right? They either can't stay on topic, they go down rat holes, they get passionate about a solution that isn't on topic. Any advice from your own experience on either how you have prepped people, how you need them to behave in a meeting, or do you just cut your losses and don't invite them because you know, even though they could add some value, they actually have a deleterious or diminishing impact on the meeting? Any experience there?
Yeah, and it cuts through all layers of the book, actually, Scott. We have this crazy notion that we have to sort of tiptoe around people who wear a white collar and we treat everybody else differently. If you and I are running a manufacturing plant and someone is not making the car or making the widget right, are we going to go, well, you know, I mean, that it's okay. It's okay if they don't make the car. No, we say, this is how you make a car. This is how you do things. If we're running a sports team, you don't say, well, you get to kind of throw the pass to whoever you want and do it, kind of do your own thing. No, we say, this is the way you operate on the athletic field. So we win a championship. The same thing is true with people in the office. And so I've over and over again, I've said, this is how we're going to run a meeting. I'm going to model it. Okay. Then I'm going to let you start running the meeting. And after the meeting, no, I'm very prescriptive. I said, you let that person talk too long. You need to be able to politely say, I think we have the point down. Now it's time to move on to the next issue. So you absolutely have to do it this way. And just to finish up, because I was talking about Jeff Bezos, can you imagine Jeff Bezos building Amazon, sitting in a meeting with someone who is droning on and on and on? For a second, would you think that that person would tolerate that? Or Steve Jobs or Sam Walton? Go down your history of business heroes. Of course they wouldn't. So why should we?
Let's pivot to terminations and exits. Your chapter is called Breaking Up is Hard to Do. I think it was based on like Neil Sedaka's song or something like that. Rattle off some of the important aspects you write about, including how important preparation is when you know you are going to exit an employee from the firm, the organization. You talk about compassion and preparation. Rattle us through, everyone's going to face this in your career multiple times if you are an effective leader. Give us a primer on that.
Sure. So if you're going to be a leader, you have to let people go. There's no escaping it. And so the first thing is accepting it is part of your job description. It's not an intrusion in your day. It's the first thing. Second thing, in prior chapters, we talk about instant performance feedback and how to give feedback to underperformers. If you follow those steps, when it comes to someone who you think you're going to need to let go, you know that you've done everything you can do. And I also outlined three questions or three frameworks to determine whether you need to let someone go or not. Because a lot of times we agonize over, and then you keep putting it off and kicking the can down the alley. Well, that's not how you build a high-performing team. So the first thing is identifying who's a problem or who's suffering or struggling, and then going through the steps to give them the best chance of success. If they have not been able to do that, then you know you've done everything you can. And so then how you show compassion is through preparation. And the reason I say, you know, breaking up is hard to do is the idea that we're going to somehow try to morph this conversation into a way that is not painful for the other person. It doesn't work that way. Breaking up is hard to do. But how you show your compassion and your humanity is preparing for it. So in class, for example, we'll practice a termination, and I'll call on someone, I'll have them terminate me, for example. And I'll say, well, what about my severance? Oftentimes a student will say, well, what do you think is fair? That's when you start to degrade compassion. That's not compassionate to put on the other person. What you do is you're prepared for that. For COBRA, the continuing health benefits, we make sure that the forms are filled out, they're complete. Everything we can do, we do everything we can to make the logistics of the termination as gentle as possible. And we talk about how you don't get into the reasons why you're terminating the person, because that often just degrades into a he said, she said, or an argument. And you end up, all of a sudden you realize that all I've been doing is like kicking this person while they're down. So you can move that to an alternate meeting. You can say, look, Scott, the purpose of this meeting is to talk about the terms of the terms of your separation. If you'd like to talk about more details about how we got to this decision, we'll have a separate meeting for that. So these are kind of the things that you do to show your compassion around letting someone go.
David, I think it's extraordinarily valuable. Obviously, the author, Brené Brown, says, you know, clear is kind. What you're talking about is just making sure that you've done your preparation, if the decision is final, that you're not in a debate about it. It's not a conversation as much as it is a clear and succinct download of what the facts are. And then, like you said, if you want to talk about the why behind the what, we can schedule a separate conversation for that. This chapter is worth the book alone, because it's going to help you respect people. It really is high on compassion and empathy, even though it's probably high on clarity and even curtness. I want to go to a different chapter. You call it the 100-day window. I want to read a passage out of the book and then have you expand on it. Vigilant, clear, and supportive onboarding is important is as important to successful hiring as interviews or reference checks. The Harvard Business Review reports that 40 to 60% of new hires fail within 18 months. Much of this has to do with poor onboarding. Today we know that employees who go through a structured onboarding process are nearly two-thirds more likely to be with the company after 3 years than those who didn't. Let's talk about what you call the 100-day window, and everyone who's listening right now is going to benchmark their onboarding process or lack of one against what you're telling us in terms of maybe some of the big tranches of important parts of their onboarding process.
Great. And by the way, Scott, it's even more important now because now in 2024, we live in a world where there's a lot of remote work. Yep. The connective tissue that we have with our employees or with each other on the team is not the same. Everybody's kind of out for bid on LinkedIn every day. So this is even more important today. Okay, first of all, there's a mindset, which is even the best people at hiring have about a 20-25% unsuccess rate. So the hiring process does not end when you make the offer. So the onboarding is bifurcated into two areas. One is we want to make sure that we made a good hiring decision. The second is we want to maximize this person's chance of success and that they'll stay with the company. So the book describes in the first one, we call it vigilance, a structured process on how you make sure you made a right decision, because you will learn more in the first week of that person's being on the job in your company or in your organization than you did through the whole interviewing process and recruiting process. And it's better for both you and the candidate or the new employee to find out that it's not going to work within a month than 6 or 7 months down the road. But you've got you're battling this confirmation bias. You don't want to be wrong. And so the book outlines specific things that you do in a structured way to maximize the chances that you identify if you made a mistake or not. The second part of it is the onboarding process. And I want you to think about it this way, Scott. Imagine like you're driving to work. And the first couple days you're driving to work, you don't know where to get gas and where the parking is. And then you get to work and you don't know who fixes your laptop and so forth. There's a fair amount of discomfort. You don't know who have lunch. Do people go out on Thursday nights? All of those kind of norms. It's important that you structurally get people through those norms on how we do things with the company and where to park your car and how to get your laptop fixed or whatever early on, because that's when that employee is most vulnerable about leaving. Once they get kind of settled in and they know people and like people, then you've got some resilience around the working relationship. So how do you do that? So for example, I talk about Madison Reed and Amy Arett, who's the CEO of Madison Reed. Every single new employee, now Madison Reed's a big company, every single employee is welcomed on a Wednesday Zoom call, and they show up on the Zoom with balloons behind them, so they know everybody knows who the new employees are, and their manager introduces them playfully with two truths and a lie. So it's just one example of how you make the person feel comfortable. So that when they go into the lunchroom, people go, "Oh, that's the new person. Come on, sit with us." So the book goes through about a dozen specific things that the best companies do to onboard employees. Think about if you increase, you mentioned the two-thirds number. If you increase by one-third the number of people that stay with your company that you want to keep, just on the cost savings alone is incredible.
Sir, you are the real deal. I've kind of hit a tipping point in my fatigue reading books from organizational behavior PhDs at universities that have never hired or fired a person in their life, that have never managed a P&L, that have never sweated out bringing their quarterly revenue number in at the last minute managing a dozen salespeople, that have never had to make really tough decisions on allocating resources. I'm kind of over reading the only academic books on leadership, because if you've not hired or fired people, I'm not reading your book. You, however, I think are a very nice blend of teaching the business principles at Stanford that you've learned in your many roles. This book is extraordinary. Again, I encourage people to pick up the Manager's Handbook. I want to talk about, you know, kind of what else you've learned. You write a lot about this sort of fierce management of your time. What have you learned are some of the best things that successful leaders, managers do to keep on top of what is their most precious asset, and that is their time, the allocation of their own time?
Two things sort of converged on this. You know, I, by the way, I didn't sort of come up with these five things and then decide to write a book. I identified that the sort of the common reasons why we thought some companies succeeded and didn't succeed were wrong. And then I went out and I investigated the best companies out there and the best leaders and managers and found these five characteristics. And I stumbled upon the time management one. I was having a cup of coffee with a friend of mine, Tom Staggs, who at the time was CEO of Disney. And I got there a couple minutes late and I'm fretting over the emails I haven't answered over. And there he is, calm as can be. And he's running an organization that had over 200,000 people in six continents. And I talked to Tom about it. And he said that one of the most important things he does is he's very good at managing his time. And then he's very good at teaching his staff how to manage their time. So they're very good at teaching their staff how to manage their time. That was followed up not too long after that with a conversation I was having with Michael Porter, a friend of mine, and he told me about this study that he had done where they followed 27 high-performing CEOs and collected 60,000 hours of data on how they spent their time. And what was clear is that they were very, very protective of their time because they knew that that was their scarce resource. But when I went and looked at how everybody did it a little bit differently, and some people had kind of exotic ways that they managed their time and so forth. So what I did is, Scott, I pulled out the easy, simple, like low-hanging fruit, if you will, if you pardon the expression, that all of these managers did. So for example, this saves you 70 minutes a day, and your listeners can do it tomorrow morning, is you take all those hour-long meetings and you turn them into 40-minute meetings. You take all those 30-minute meetings and you turn them into 20-minute meetings. That alone, if you have a typical calendar, will save you 70 minutes right off the bat. So what I looked for is I wasn't suggesting that people should go away for a 7-day seminar on time management or completely re-engineer their work. It's basically, here are a handful of things that you can do to recapture hours in your week.
David, you said something earlier I think that is profound, and I want to kind of end our conversation on this. You said, loosely quoted, everybody's in a bidding war right now, up for bid, on LinkedIn. And I think this is a great way to end our conversation because that is true. If leaders and managers don't think that every one of their team members is being actively recruited from all of their competition, they're delusional. Because you've done all the work to train the people and get them matured and acclimated, and therefore your competition can pay them more money and still save a tremendous amount of resources. Will you remind everyone listening of that reality? And what in your experience do you think leaders and managers should be doing to re-recruit? They spend most of their time recruiting and very little time re-recruiting. What should we be doing, A, to be aware of the constant bidding process, and be best practices around keeping your high performers engaged to inoculate them from being poached by your competition?
I can really simplify this down, Scott, is I think the most important thing you can do to keep the top high-performing people on your team is to manage well. Now, let me explain. I'm finishing up the Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls. I think I'm the last person to watch it, the Last Dance. And I'm watching this championship team and realizing once again that champions want to work for high performing, but also very demanding organizations. That's where the best players want to be. So if you want to keep the best players, what you do is you manage really, really well. And I realize that might seem simplistic, but if you give people feedback, instant performance feedback, like I know you've had Kim Scott on the class using radical candor, and that you people who are not working out, you allow them a dignified exit out of the company by, we're talking about exits, that you have an obsession with quality and you measure quality in a certain way, you treat your customers a certain way. These are all the basic building blocks of management. And if you do that, people don't want to leave because they don't want to leave the championship team for the AA team. And that to me, that is the single most important thing that you can do. And the gimmicks, all the things that you can do that, you know, you mentioned sort of people have never managed before, you know, here's the slogan of the day. That doesn't work because champions just want to be with high performing organizations.
Michael, who's your most influential mentor in your life? And what lesson did you learn from her or him?
The most influential mentor in my life is, I mentioned him at the beginning, Irv Grossbeck. And he and a partner built a very, very large media company before he taught at Harvard, and then he went to talk to Stanford. And here's why he was such an important mentor in my life. and he was on many of my boards, and I taught with him at Stanford. He still teaches at Stanford. Is he pointed out that your humanity and bringing, you know, love and kindness into the workplace is not only your responsibility, it's part of good management. And then he modeled it for me. Because, you know, if you just go with the words, you're like, yeah, but I got a job too. And he showed me and taught me how I can be everything I want to be as a human being, how I can bring my experience as a dad or as a partner with my wife, and I can bring that humanity and empathy into the workplace and to do all of these other things with more effectively because of that. You know, we talk about instant performance feedback, and there's 6 steps to instant performance feedback. Well, if you do all those steps alongside empathy and caring and love, it is so much more effective. And that's what I learned from Irv Grossbeck.
I want to ask you one more question. And I've mentioned this many times on this podcast. The best advice I ever received in my senior level career was from our current chairman and former CEO, Bob Whitman. And Bob once said to me, thinking is a legitimate business activity. Meaning just like putting your feet up on your desk and staring out the window and putting your arms behind your neck or whatever your version of that is, and just thinking about your brand, your strategy, your strengths, opportunities, partnerships, people, relationships. And I'm not very good at that because I tend to be a very productive, hyper-efficient person. It has served me well in some areas and not in others. I'm that kind of guy that my phone is ringing off the hook at a dinner table or at emails and social media stuff and kind of discombobulated, but got a lot going on. And I want to become a little more deliberate and a little less responsive. I want to be more in control of my priorities and my time and spend more time thinking. From what you've written in the book or you've already said in the podcast, is there any advice you would offer me and those listening who can relate to sort of my trying to think long-term in a short-term world, but being so subject to demands, right? Podcast interviews and audio, but you name it. What would you send us off with?
Yeah, I talk specifically about this in the book with Watson, who eventually ran IBM, and how, you know, he said part of my job description is think, and that ended up being the name of the company newsletter at IBM. It is absolutely part of your job description. And I was smiling at one point because a CEO who I've come to admire, and I was on his board actually with Joel Peterson, a company called Asurion, Kevin Tweel, the CEO there, viewed part of his job description is as kicking his feet up on the desk and staring out the window and thinking about it and thinking. But it's one thing to sort of understand that concept, but it's another thing to do it because you get caught in the urgencies of the day and the emails flying, you know, and your Slack channel's blowing up and you forget about it. And so I specifically talk about the concept of deep work, which is outlined in Cal Newport's book, which is by the same name, Deep Work, and how you have to structure deep work and thinking time into your daily planning. Yeah. And it's not hard to do if you understand that it's important. And so it's not about sort of an aspiration. You have to have the aspiration, but then you also have to structure your day in a way that allows for this to happen. Otherwise, the urgencies of the day will overcome it. And I make the case, and I think it's a strong and compelling case, that where true value is added to your organization is in your deep work time. And that's why when we talk about time management, fanatical custodian of time, we talk about quantity of time, okay, reducing your minutes, your meetings from 60 minutes to 40 minutes, but also how you manage your quality of time so that you have this time to really add true shareholder value or organizational value.
David Dotson, former McKinsey consultant, professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, serial entrepreneur, investor in over 100 companies, Wall Street Journal and USA Today best-selling author of this book, The Manager's Handbook, 5 Simple Steps to Build a Team, Stay Focused, Make Better Decisions, and Crush Your Competition. Superb read. So delighted you joined us today. Thanks for your time, my friend.
You're quite welcome.
And we'll see you back here next week for a new conversation on leadership and management.